Hey everyone, welcome back to the book club. I've been absent for a little bit, and I wanted to touch on that real briefly because it keys in on something that I think we'll talk about a little later on in the text, although it doesn't so much come up in Capital, which is kind of interesting. Marx has this term called reproductive labor, right? And I'm not sure if that's the translation or what it would be in the actual German. I will admit to not really knowing. But I think a lot of times this term reproductive labor is actually held up to be somewhat sexist or seems to have some sexist overtones. And while Marx certainly can be critiqued for sexism through his work, I think reproductive labor, again, whether or not it's the translation or not, is actually quite a useful term for, loosely put, housework, right? So the past week, my wife was out of town, and we split stuff up relatively evenly. I'm sure on some level, like most households, she gets more than I do just because of socialization and stuff, but we do our best, or I do my best too. But doing all the work in the house was surprising, always is, because not only then are you doing the work you do at your job, but you're also reproducing the occasions from which you get your rest, you get your peace, you get your recharging to go then go ahead and do your job again. So when Marx calls this reproductive labor, I think it gets this tone of, I think it gets this gendered tone in some part because, of course, when Marx is writing this, and even to today, women predominantly do the reproductive labor. However, I think it also gets the sense of like neonatal or like obstetrics or something like that. Like it's about giving birth to children or something. It's not what reproductive labor means. And in fact, like if you stop and like do all your housework, or if you are responsible for doing all your housework or most of the housework, you know that, or you can conceptualize that there is a sense of added strain to having to not only go out and do the work itself, but also then come home and make sure the conditions are back to, you know, that they're clean enough, that you're eating enough, that you have set up your coffee machine, that you've put gas in your car, that you've made sure that all your stuff is in the right place, that your clothes are out, right? All that stuff reproduces the possibility, the conditions of, you know, your productivity as a laborer. So that reproductive labor is not something that the, you know, the management puts together. It's not like your boss helps you with that necessarily. You have to do that. And so it's an added element to labor power that is in fact totally unpaid. And that's really interesting. And I think it's something that we need to keep in mind as we move forward if we talk about reproductive labor again, because I'm always reminded of it when I have to do it more than usual. It is a massive amount of work. And without it, labor power as we know it can't really function. So that's just the beginning. What I wanted to talk about today is kind of short piece. People seem to want a short hit. So I'm going to do that. And then probably another hour episode, probably coming out Thursday. This episode is a really short hit on the commodity fetish. Now, the commodity fetish is a very common term that Marx uses. There's a whole chapter or section that we'll cover on Thursday that's called, and we'll be pulling from it today, it's called the commodity fetish. The fetishism of the commodity and its secret. This is in the first section. It starts on page 163 of the Fowkes translation. but this term commodity fetish is something that comes up a lot in Marxism, and it's very rarely pinned down. I think a lot of times, like, people use the idea of the commodity fetish as either just like a catch-all for commodity, or in this incorrect, let's just be honest, incorrect way of saying that, like, the commodity is sexualized or otherwise, like, part of this this pleasure principle that would be associated with sexual fetish. It has nothing to do with the sexual fetish. It has something to do with the religious fetish, particularly something like, you know, you don't even have to go into the problematic anthropology of something. You can just say, say a crucifix would operate as something imbued with a kind of power through spirituality. Marx sees commodities given this kind of power as well. And the commodity fetish, the whole section on the commodity fetish, is trying to figure out why they have that power in the first place. And so I'm going to explain what he means by that. I'm going to explain how they have the power. I'm going to explain why that's important to you thinking through this book with me and thinking through just like capitalism in general. So to start at the beginning, Marx asks this question, and these pages, I'm really only going to cover three pages today, and these pages are really emblematic of a particular thing in Marx, where he will write about a super important thing, but it comes off as if he's just kind of doing that paratactic, okay, here's what we've covered before, here's what we've covered before, here's what we've covered before. Like, these three pages don't seem super important until you break them down. They seem like what he's just kind of going back and saying once again, okay, like, as we said in our last episode, use value isn't actually all that important in codifying what a commodity is. And of course, that's where he starts. He says, you know, he says, a commodity appears at first sight an extremely obvious, trivial thing, which of course it does. So imagine a widget. You go into the store, you go into the Apple store, and you can buy a dongle for your computer to hook up to a projector. Fine. It's trivial. It's nothing. You know, it costs you money and you need it to project your PowerPoint or whatever. But other than that, it's not really all that important. However, it just appears that way. Its analysis, as he says, brings out that it is a very strange thing, abounding in the metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. So far as it is a use value, there is nothing mysterious about it. Whether we consider it from the point of view that by its properties it satisfies human needs, or that it first takes on these properties as the product of human labor, it is absolutely clear that by his activity, man changes the form of his materials of nature in such a way to make them useful to him. So again, all he's saying here is that, you know, ultimately we take the objects in the world and turn them into stuff. So nothing weird about the fact that, yeah, okay, I'm taking a bunch of wood, as he says, and turning it into a table. There's nothing weird about me, you know, there's nothing strange, there's nothing sort of like that we need to figure out. If I take a couple of 2x4s, some nails, and make a sort of badly put together table, it's just the table, it's not all that interesting. So whence the commodity is basically the question here, right? The form of wood, he says, is altered if a table's made out of it. Nevertheless, the table continues to be wood, right? Okay, the 2x4s have now become a table, but the table is still wood. In sort of the Hegelian version, the appearance of the table, our sort of social understanding of the table, is that it's also still wood, right? We don't look at it and say, well, that's something else besides wood. However, once it emerges as a commodity, which is to say, once you see a table like that in like the Home Depot or IKEA, it changes into a thing that transcends sensuousness, which again moves on from that sort of essence into the world of social appearance. And sociality becomes really important here. It not only stands with its feet on the ground, but in relation to all other commodities, it stands on its head and evolves out of its wooden brain grotesque ideas far more wonderful than if it were to begin dancing of its own free will. The idea here, and this is a language Marx uses all the time, is that the commodity becomes, instead of this obvious thing, if you actually think about what it is, it's not a table anymore. It has actually transformed itself into the sort of mystical, call it like a post-table, table two, table to the second power. There's something about the table that is no longer table-like. Right? It is a commodity. It's different now. So the question is, what makes it magical and what makes it fantastical? And here's where Marx kind of goes into some work that might seem like it's retreading old thoughts, but it's actually kind of like drawing in these really interesting new claims. So he says the mystical character of the commodity does not arise from its use value. Of course, right? It's not that, you know, if we look at a table and it's just you and me standing around, if we made a table, the appearance of the table as its tableness is that it is made of wood, it holds things on it. If I'm at IKEA, the appearance of the table and sort of like my social situation, we're all looking at the table outside of its sensuous quality. We understand that it's an IKEA table for sale at IKEA, related to every other commodity in the store based on price, usefulness, our need for it, how sturdy we think it is, its style, etc. Right? So it's something different. It doesn't have to necessarily do with its use value. That's some element of it, but it has to do with much, much more. Another way of saying this is you can use a commodity, but a commodity does not need to be useful to be sold. Nor does a commodity creator care what you use the commodity for. If I bought a table and used it to jump through in a backyard wrestling match, IKEA wouldn't care. They wouldn't, you know, yell at me for not putting drinks on it and instead breaking it. They'd be pleased that I'd have to go buy another table. So it doesn't come from the use value. And then he says it doesn't come from the nature of the determinants of value either, which isn't to say, you know, you don't add up the number of boards that it took. And like, if it took more boards, it's more expensive. This is again, like Akewood did a good job with this. Chris Onstad's Akewood, when it was talked about, like he had a story arc where Todd Squirrel came up with this idea to put basically truck nuts on a phone. And Ray Smuckles, the sort of entrepreneur of the whole thing, says the most expensive one is actually not three nuts, but one. You make it minimal, right? And that's true. Like, that's, look at Kickstarter, listen to the brilliant Your Kickstarter Sucks by Jesse Farrar and Mike Hale. This minimal thing is absolutely a moneymaker. It's not about what goes into it at all. Like, the determinants of its value, like the things that make it up, more is not always going to lend itself to more expensive. Okay. And so he goes on and he says, like, basically, like, you know, it's not use value because all of those things, they're physiological, they're functions of human labor. It's, you know, that's not magical. It's what a table would be, right? Second, it says, with the regard to the foundation of the quantitative determination of value, the quality of a thing has nothing to do with how much time you spend building it or what you spend building it. It just doesn't. Like, things are valued not based on, you know, did it take 45 hours or did it take 12? Again, it goes back to the socially necessary labor time, right? It's all standardized. So it's not about that either. And then finally, the labor time it costs to produce the means of subsistence must necessarily concern mankind, although not to the same degree at different stages of development. So it doesn't have to do with actually like commodities. This is something that would concern people generally. It doesn't explain the mystical quality of the commodity. And finally, he says, like, the sociality of it, just that it's social, doesn't explain it either. Because, you know, if I see you and I say, hey, I need some help moving this big rock away from my property so I can grow land on this fallow spot, and you say, well, okay, can you give me 7 apples? I say, yeah, sure. We've entered into a social contract. We aren't exchanging commodities, but we are exchanging sociality. So what's going on here? And so Marx goes on and says, basically, simply put, exchange does it. Exchange is what transforms a commodity into its mystical self, and particularly exchange on a marketplace, in a marketplace that uses the money form. So he says it arises from the form of the commodity itself, the enigmatic quality. And what he means by this is that when you have the commodity in the marketplace, he says the kinds of human labor take on a physical form in the equal objectivity of the products of labor as values, which is to say, you can even out and zero out all the different ways in which labor, products, materials, anything at all has to do with the production and value of a thing by giving everything prices that standardize their value, right? Commodities speak to each other. They don't speak to the actual labor or human power that created them. Fine. He goes on, the measure of the expenditure of human labor power by its duration takes on the form of the magnitude of the value of the products of labor. Okay, right. Yeah, magnitude of value, not magnitude of material. And then finally, the relationships between the producers, which is to say, you move this rock, I'll give you apples, take on the form of a social relation between the products of labor, which is to say, an IKEA table is related not to the labor power of the person who created the table and the labor power of the person who created the bookshelf, but the two are related to each other based on, okay, which one costs more? What do I need more? What do I want more? What looks better, right? You could even compare two tables this way and it would probably be better. So everything goes into the commodity. It's not about labor power. It's not about human power. It's not about human relation. It's all about the thing itself manifesting value in the market. And so then he goes on to say, like, basically, the mystical quality of the whole thing is simply the fact that the commodity reflects the social characteristics of men's own labor, this is a quote, as objective characteristics of the products of labor themselves, as the socio-natural properties of these things. Again, the characteristics of labor are transformed via exchange into objective characteristics of the products of labor themselves, which is to say, the table removes any indication that it was created. It doesn't give you any idea that like someone actually made it in a factory. Think about like your cup of coffee. You get a cup of coffee, right? You order it from Starbucks or from your local brewery or whatever, right? You get the coffee and you drink it. You don't really think about, okay, where did the beans come from and who roasted the beans and who harvested the beans and how did the beans get here via transport and what are we doing in terms of fossil fuels that way and are we paying everyone the same way? And, you know, and of course, like, you know, your coffee brewer might say, oh, these are fair trade beans. Well, okay, but there's eight other steps in there. And like, you don't see them. You don't see them when you pick up a coffee. And I don't either. It's not about you. This is how it works. The coffee is a coffee. It's not a product of labor. It's simply a product in the world. The fetish or the commodity, its mystical quality, takes away all of its context. And all of a sudden, it's just a thing in the world that you can buy, right? So it reflects, he says, the social relation of the producers to the sum total of labor as a social relation between objects. The objects speak to each other and the objects speak to you. You don't see the labor, you just see the objects, is what he's saying. He calls this, he says that the products of labor become commodities. And he argues, he defines commodities as, quote, sensuous things which are at the same time suprasensible or social. So they are sensual things that basically skip the reality of appearance and appear or take the form of appearance of things that just exist in the world and are social on their own terms. We don't ask where the table came from. We simply understand its position in the world as an object that basically has its own autonomy. And he goes on and sort of explains this as like he analogizes it to like seeing something, right? Like I'm looking across my desk and I'm seeing this globe we have, right? But I'm not actually seeing the globe. The light is bouncing off of the globe and entering my eye and interacting with the optic nerve and producing an image, right? There's all sorts of like complicated things that are happening, but it's not like there's not a one-to-one thing like I imagine there is. That's kind of how the commodity works. But he says this doesn't quite work. And in fact, the only way we can understand it is by relating it to a fetish. And he means a religious fetish here, where he says it's the misty realm of religion. There, the products of the human brain appear as autonomous figures endowed with a life of their own, which enter into relations both with each other and with the human race. And so this is like this completely goes back to thinking to a Hegelian trope, particularly something Hegel says about relics and arguing that if you unearth the relics in a church, if you take up the bones, what you will find is that the bones are just bones, right? They need to exist in the church. They need to be entombed in the church in order to maintain their qualities as fetishes. And if you unearth the labor that it takes to build the table is no longer IKEA Malm or whatever. It's like the product of labor. However, if you don't unearth the bones and you don't find out that the bones are just bones, they keep this sort of potential and powerful quality to them where they effectively exist as a fetish. And a fetish in this case is something that is created by man and then in a double switch turned into something that has religious as opposed to material or social qualities, right? Qualities that supersede the conditions of its creation. And that's the important thing. And that's why the commodity fetish is important, not because it describes some sort of perversion of capitalist exchange, but because it exists as the basic function of capitalist exchange, that everything you buy has taken on a form that supersedes its worldly production. Even my copy of Marx here, I'm looking at Capital right here. This was produced. This was bound. The paper was made, the ink was made, the printing press was made, right? All of these things were built by people and made by people. But what I see is this book that has superseded that labor and simply appears to me as book in relation to me in this office with the other books in my office, with my desk, with this computer that I'm talking into. Everything around me is made from labor and I don't see it because I can't see it because what I see are commodities, things that cost money. The money there serves as sort of like that religious spark or that mystical spark, say with a, you know, that'll be a little less controversial, a mystical spark that imbues these things with a supra sensuous, supra social quality. They take on the form of appearance as things that are not created by human hands, but are autonomous objects in the world that interact with other objects and us. The problem or the thing that it's not the problem, it's the what commodity fetishism does and the reason we have to care about it is that it removes us from conditions of production. It makes us think the commodities are what are important, as opposed to the conditions under which they're produced or the reality of their production. And that is what we're going to see as we continue the commodity section. But understanding that the commodity is important because it produces this fetishism is absolutely crucial. So that's it for the short hit. Thanks, everyone. And I will see you again on Thursday. Please tell people about the book club. I hope you're really enjoying it. And, you know, shoot me a Patreon message, shoot me an email, shoot me anything you want, trevor.strunk@gmail.com or nocartridgeaudio@gmail.com and or Hagelbon on Twitter. And I will be more than happy to answer it as best I can. Thanks for all your support. And I'm looking forward to talking to you more about the money form and touching again on this concept of fetishism and what it produces.